This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. We hear a lot about the challenges facing rural America. New research from the University of New Hampshire says one-third of rural counties are experiencing protracted and significant population loss. One-third. These counties now have 6 million residents. That's down by a third from 1950. The idea of leaving small-town America for opportunity in the big city is nothing new. From hopping on a bus to Hollywood, to the exodus of Black Americans known as the Great Migration. But across the country, more people are doing the exact opposite. They're either staying in their small hometowns or moving back to fight for the places they love. And more journalists are working to add those voices to a broader story about a more diverse and changing rural America. Joining us from KMUW Public Radio in Wichita is Sarah Smarsh, the host and executive producer of The Homecomers, a new podcast that highlights voices from rural America. Sarah, welcome to 1A.
Hey, Joshua. Thanks for having me.
Joining us here in studio is April Simpson, a reporter covering rural issues for Stateline. That's a new service funded by the Pew Charitable Trusts. April, welcome.
Thank you.
Sarah Smarsh, let me start with you. You've described yourself as a fifth-generation Kansas farm girl. Is that right?
That's right.
Now, you've worked as a journalist in New York and around the world, but you decided to move back home to Kansas. Tell us about the moment you made that decision.
Yeah, it was actually probably the most controversial decision I've ever made in my life. People thought I'd done lost my mind, but I actually left New York City in my mid-20s when I had just sort of initially, after a great deal of hard work, made the sort of social connections and kind of cultural capital that might have allowed for a life made there. I had a different value set, I guess, ultimately than some of the value sets that are more often favored by, I don't know, for lack of a better word, capitalism. I knew I was going to make less money if I moved back to Kansas, but I missed my family. My roots are so deep in this place that I feel at home here, and it has worked out.
What were the big things that you missed?
Oh, gosh. I know we're going to talk about a lot about ideas, but just to ground all of this in the earth, I miss the place, the landscape, the big sky, the flat horizon. I love New York City, but to be in that sort of congested concrete environment is quite foreign to someone who grew up seeing all the way to the horizon. You see a thunderstorm coming almost from the Rockies, it seems, across the whole flat state. There, it's not a monotonously flat state, but where I grew up, it is sort of the stereotypical landscape of farmland and big thunderstorms and the smell of alfalfa when I'm helping my family do the chores.
Anything you miss about New York?
Oh, gosh, of course. I'm always happy to visit, and I'm there a few times a year. Just the energy and the vibrancy and the constant buzz. Those are all things that are in me, too, that drew me to that place. But like a lot of folks, I kind of straddle two different socioeconomic classes, two different worlds, in a sense. I even tell people I speak two versions of English, country and fancy. So I've tried to find a way to have both.
Well, I speak both, so if you want a code switch, you go right ahead. We can translate for our listeners on
cool.
The coast. Tell me about the podcast, The Homecomers. What's it about?
In this journey of mine, kind of carving that professional path where I'm also honoring my home, I have found like-minded individuals and sensed that there's something underfoot, underreported, a movement, small but steady, of folks like myself who are either returning to a place or staying in a place, even if they've got other options, in part because maybe for political reasons they want to fight for that place in a progressive sense, maybe for the kind of family ties I was talking about earlier, maybe just a sense of wellness at being one with the land. And so I wanted to explore that. About a year and a half ago, I had an opportunity to do a research fellowship at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and I looked into this, and I thought this needs to be a podcast for rural America, for that population, also for the greater listenership to learn about this. But there's just so little in that space that's content created for folks who care about rural America and are in rural America, not to paint their issues and concerns as very narrow, but But it's rarely a demographic that's considered in that realm, and so I made it.
Well, definitely some of our listeners think that there's a lot to be said about rural America and shared what they like about living in rural areas. Here's a quick mashup of what a few listeners left in our inbox.
Hi, I'm Lucy Myers from Rolla, Missouri.
This is Craig from northeastern Minnesota.
My name is Stephanie Kovichka, and I'm calling from Wharton, Texas.
What I love about being in a rural area is there's a deeper sense of community.
The benefits of a small town are, one, low-cost housing, two, less traffic, no congestion, and the availability of being outdoors.
I grew up in this town. I couldn't wait to leave, and very quickly came back and was able to fall in love with this place because of the history here and the shared history that residents have.
I would say rural areas are really undersold.
I think living in a smaller community has really taught me the meaning of community, which is a lifelong blessing.
Yeah, Lucy and Craig and Stephanie, thank you so much for sharing your stories with us. And before I come to April Simpson to talk about some of the stories you've been reporting, Sarah, the name of the podcast, The Homecomers, what's behind the name?
Well, that was actually coined by Wes Jackson. He had something called the Land Institute here in Kansas. They're working on developing perennial wheat, which is a quite progressive agricultural pursuit. And he was articulating this same sort of trend or would-be individual who would return to a place that felt like home to help improve and protect it. And that could involve land stewardship. It could involve politics. It could involve family and community in an apolitical way. But I interview six folks who kind of meet that description in broadly different ways. Everybody from a political scientist who is a black farmer's advocate to a labor activist who was raised by immigrant farm workers in the Central Valley. I even talked to former Secretary of Health Kathleen Sebelius about access to health care in rural areas. She chose to move back to Kansas from D.C. when she left the Obama administration, and she fights for progress here. So it's very intimate conversations. I very much wanted to make these issues feel real and humanized rather than abstract the way that they can get in headlines.
And when you say the Central Valley, you mean the Central Valley of California,
That's the
right. I-5 corridor, basically.
Yes.
All right. April Simpson, let me talk to you about some of your reporting at Stateline. It's interesting because there are these other stories out of rural America, the South and the Midwest and so forth, that bear telling. There are also other stories that are kind of less flattering, including just the lack of opportunity there. Brandon tweeted, "Born and raised in the rural deep South, myself and every sibling left our small town. Why? No jobs. 30 years later and revisiting the area, there are even less jobs." How do we balance the storytelling about rural America so we don't just kind of make it this hagiography, this kind of pastoral, you know, Saturday Evening Post image of what people idealize it as?
I think, obviously, as you hit on, there are a lot of challenges, you know, in population loss, the loss of industry and so on, and that is important and needs to be reflected. But I think it's also important to show what's working and to show, like what Sarah hit on, the people who are really invested in their communities and wanting to, create places that people will want to come back to. So, you know, for example, I did a story about exchange programs that help people feel more rooted in their states. In Kentucky, for example, they have folks from Louisville going to Southeast Kentucky, where they may not have ever gone, and learning about coal country. And then, you know, having the same in the reverse. So it helps people feel more rooted in their places. It also shows that there are people on the ground who are invested and doing the work.
Glad to get some of your stories and thoughts, including about some of the issues that rural America faces. Donald says, ask about doctors and hospitals in rural America. April, maybe you can help us with that, and we'll get to some more of your stories in a minute. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from CarMax. For more than 25 years, CarMax has made it easy to sell your car. They provide free appraisals and offers on the spot. CarMax will buy your car even if you don't buy theirs. In fact, CarMax has bought more than 8 million vehicles. To learn more and schedule your free appraisal, visit CarMax.com.
Just a few years before starring in Book of Mormon, Andrew Rannells was way off Broadway doing, and I quote, "It's Karate Kid, the musical."
This is the punctuation. "It's Karate, comma, Kid, colon, the musical," for legal purposes.
The stories behind the celebrities, every Tuesday on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're talking about some of the stories in rural America that don't always get told, but should be told. Glad to get some of your stories, including from Haley. Haley emailed, "My husband and I, with our two young children just this month, have moved back to our rural Michigan hometown after more than a decade away. We love our small town and have big dreams to help support it. However, the challenges are immense in ways that prosperous urban areas can't understand. Healthcare is a huge challenge as small towns struggle to attract talented professionals. People are poor. There is no money for anything. And this is a once middle-class, blue-collar town that completely fizzled out with the collapse of the industrial Midwest." April, I wonder if you could react to the healthcare piece of what Haley asked. We heard from Donald, who asked about doctors and hospitals in rural America.
Sure. So in a lot of hospitals in some rural areas have closed. So, for example, Tennessee has seen 9 hospitals close since 2012, and that's the second highest rate after Texas. There's also, you know, a rising U.S. Maternal mortality rate, and that is often worse in rural areas. Women in some places have to travel 30 minutes to an hour to get to the nearest hospital where they can receive obstetric services. I did a story recently about midwives who are trying to fill this gap in rural healthcare, working with pregnant women and, you know, providing these services that, you know, they have such challenges in accessing.
Sarah, I'd like to get your reaction to the other part of Haley's email that has to do with just the economic issues, that poverty yet remains, and then jobs have fizzled out largely due to, you know, automation and globalization. How are you addressing those kinds of stories?
Sure. So, well, for one thing, in the homecomers, I talk to people who kind of span the socioeconomic continuum in terms of resources. Some of them grew up in deep poverty. Some identified as working poor. Others even upper middle class. Rural America has folks at all economic rungs, of course. But the sort of troubles that your caller identified are very real and very deep. And the stories that I tell in this show don't at all sugarcoat those. In fact, I think the possibility and in some ways even the excitement and the hope about that space now and the folks who want to fight for it, albeit with immense challenges ahead, is the opportunity to rebuild something. You know, that you mentioned that sort of pastoral stereotype, and that isn't the farm life I lived. My family's bodies were broken by the manual labor that they did. The corneas of my eyes got sunburnt while I was working in wheat fields. So I'm not one to sentimentalize, but I can simultaneously love that place and want to rebuild it into an even better, more equitable and inclusive space. That's along lines of class, race, gender, and so on. I interview a woman in the homecomers who founded the Female Farmers Project. She's trying to boost women in agriculture. One of them founded the Black Farmers Network. Agriculture is actually a minority population within rural, but it's an important one that links to urban America and everywhere else. So I think it's the rebuilding that comes with some hope and excitement.
Sarah, let's play a few clips from the podcast. Here's one from the first episode. It's an interview with Dr. Veronica Womack, who is a professor at Georgia College in Milledgeville, Georgia. Before we play the clip, tell us more about Veronica Womack and why you wanted to talk to her.
Sure. So Dr. Womack is a daughter of the Black Belt. That's a kind of crescent-shaped region that stretches across the American South that is densely populated by African Americans, and it's a rural place and historically a very poor place. And she's from there. She's a brilliant woman. She has an incredible career, and she has decided to commit that career and her research and her advocacy work to the place that she's from. So we kind of had a connection in that while we come from very different places and faced very different types of challenges, we really vibed on the sense of community about a place. And there's so much that she was talking about what she loved about her home that I had my parallel in rural Kansas. And So she's fighting for that place and loving it.
Let's hear that clip from Veronica Womack of Georgia College in Milledgeville, Georgia, from episode one of The Homecomers.
We also need 21st century schools. You know, we need 21st century technology. We need to be developed in order to be competitive. We're on an uneven playing field here because in the agricultural and manufacturing economy, we were equipped for those economies. We were developed for that. And we've got to get developed to be able to compete in the global economy.
That's Veronica Womack of Georgia College in Milledgeville, Georgia, on The Homecomers. What are you seeing, Sarah, in terms of dealing with the educational challenges in rural America? Are the approaches that we saw at Georgia College kind of the norm, or were there others?
I want to start with just how quickly that the education piece has shifted. So when I was a kid in the 1980s, I at one point went to literally a two-room schoolhouse. It was like Little House on the Prairie style. And the most of those little schools have consolidated. But where we find ourselves just a few decades after that childhood of mine I described is outcomes where systems and policy and big structures have hospitals close, schools close. When those go away, then so too does commerce. And so this crumbling that has been the unfortunate story for several decades it propagates itself. And that how do you rebuild that place once the school is gone? How do you attract teachers to that space? So the sort of development that Dr. Womack's talking about are really ultimately only going to be solved with big structural change.
Let's add one more voice to our conversation who's been covering some of these stories from one of our 1A Across America partner stations. Joining us from KUNC Public Radio in Greeley, Colorado, which is about an hour's drive north of Denver, is reporter Esther Honig. Esther, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you cover agricultural issues in eastern Colorado. Describe that part of the state.
It is the ag hub of Colorado. It also has the oil and gas industry. And it's a bit more conservative, politically speaking, but it's seen a lot of growth in some areas. You have a lot of home housing developments that have popped up as people commute to some of the cities, Denver, Boulder, Fort Collins, that sort of thing. There's also Greeley, another big city, so it has a little bit of everything.
You've been reporting on the town of Fort Morgan, Colorado. What makes Fort Morgan unique?
So Fort Morgan is about an hour and a half from Denver, and it's a small rural city of about 11,000 people, but a little bit over a quarter of the population is foreign born. So these are immigrants and refugees from all over the world, Somalia, Latin America, China. And just to give you a sense, there are 16 different languages spoken at the local high school. So it's actually earned it's gotten the recognition as a majority-minority city. So it's in fact one of the more diverse communities in the state.
I imagine that they kind of reshaped the demographics of Fort Morgan with their arrival.
Absolutely. Yeah. As recently as 1970, the census shows that it was predominantly white.
What drew so many immigrants to Fort Morgan?
So Fort Morgan is a big meatpacking town. You have the Cargill beef plant there that employs around 2,000 people. And this work is very labor intensive, but it doesn't require fluent English. You don't really need a high school education to do this sort of work. And it has attracted a lot of refugees and immigrants for this reason. This is the major employer. The starting wage is $15 an hour, including benefits. So for a lot of people, it's seen as a really good employment opportunity.
Esther, what sparked that influx?
You started to see in the early 2000s immigrants, mainly from Mexico and Latin America, coming to Fort Morgan from other parts of the United States and Colorado to work in the beef packing plant. And then again in 2006, you saw a sort of shift, a new influx of arrivals. And these were the refugees and the immigrants from many different parts of the world. And this happened because at that time, the federal government had started to crack down on employers for hiring undocumented workers. And so this population became a sort of alternative source of workers for the beef packing plant.
Sarah, what about you? Any trends that you see in terms of these immigrant influxes and new jobs?
Yeah, absolutely. Kansas is a microcosm of this national trend. From 2000 to 2016, every county in Kansas gained people of color. And without that shift, there would have been absolutely zero growth in those 16 years. There are also places out in western Kansas where we also have a robust meatpacking industry. They're on those same high plains of eastern Colorado that Esther's reported on, where there are now, quote unquote, minority majority counties, which is largely due to the Hispanic population that has, and also beyond Mexico and Latin America, there are large Middle Eastern populations. Immigrants are changing the face of rural America and are part of its future. In some of the reporting I've done in Western Kansas, that has been a beautiful thing for some folks.
Esther, what's it been like for the longtime residents of Fort Morgan, Colorado, to see all these new arrivals?
There have absolutely been moments in their recent history where you've seen a sort of racial tension between the longtime residents and these newer arrivals. But in my reporting, I found that in more recently, you really start to see folks embracing this diversity. And I think that's for a number of reasons. At first, people tell me, you know, it's great. It's amazing to be able to walk out on, you know, your main street in your town and meet someone from the other side of the world. It kind of brings the world to them in a way. And you start to see things like this year, the high school had their first Black homecoming king, who was an immigrant from Benin and a big soccer star. And I think that another part of that, you know, that acceptance towards or this really embracing this diversity comes from the fact that, you know, these new arrivals have, they've come and they've built businesses and they've had families here. And it's really been a lifeline for this community. You see neighboring cities like Fort Morgan who are struggling to maintain a population on the Eastern Plains and they're shrinking. And Fort Morgan has seen growth and they've seen a stabilization of their population. And so people really, I think, are acknowledging that and seeing how beneficial this has become for their community.
Well, do you get the sense, Esther, that people are actually jazzed about the diversity or about the increase in prosperity, that having these people boost the economy and puts more money in their pockets, whether they interact with these newcomers or not?
I think that at this point, from the interviews that I've done, I actually really do see an appreciation for the influence that these people bring from different parts of the world. You have the police department they want to be the first police department in the state to hire a Somali police officer. You know, these it's become a part of their identity to be a diverse town. It's something that I think that they've come to embrace.
And do you see, Esther, before we got to let you go, any ways that these kinds of changes and services and just the reception could be replicated in other rural areas? Or is Fort Morgan really kind of an outlier?
You know, I haven't done enough to look into other towns that are like Fort Morgan, and there are certainly many. I think a lot can be learned from Fort Morgan. And, you know, maybe this is something that these towns need to, you know, have a conversation amongst themselves. It certainly is a lot of change to take on. There's a lot of support and resources that, you know, these arriving communities need, and I'm sure they could learn from each other.
That's KUNC's Esther Honig in Greeley, Colorado. Esther, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
And April Simpson, a reporter who covers rural issues for Stateline. April, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We'll continue our conversation in just a moment with Sarah Smarsh about how we talk about rural America. Might have heard there's an election coming up next year, and the urban-rural divide was a big issue back in 2016. How do we talk about it in 2020, and how might some of these untold stories change the conversation? Stay close. Rolling Stone.
Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating. That helps other people find the show. And don't forget, you can catch the news roundup at the end of every week.
What do all of these people have in common? Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, and Bernie Sanders.
They're all running for president.
And they've all sat down with us on the NPR Politics podcast.
Oh, NPR is going to drive me completely crazy.
We are going out on the trail with as many of the Democratic presidential candidates as we can and are bringing you in-depth interviews with them.
Come along by subscribing to the NPR Politics podcast.
Back now to our conversation with Sarah Smarsh, the creator and host of the new podcast, The Homecomers. Sarah, let's play another clip of the podcast. Here's a clip of Brett Ramey. He's a conservationist talking about the importance of having a connection to the land.
You've said before, I think, that what you called loss of land-based knowledge is a global epidemic. How is that epidemic related to what you describe as spiritual well-being?
I think that when we're living in healthy relationships with a landscape, that we automatically understand that there aren't separations between things like the health of frogs and the health of the economy. Right? Mm. These natural systems are very good at letting us know they're all interdependent on each other.
That's conservationist Brett Ramey speaking to Sarah on The Homecomers. Talk about Mr. Ramey's background.
Sure. So Brett is a member of the Iowa tribe of Kansas and Nebraska. So he's very much committed to a spot in Kansas called White Cloud. But he actually works full time at the University of Washington, leading the Doris Duke Conservation Scholars Program. And his mission is basically to help diversify perspectives and wisdom sets within the realm of conservation. Because as we talk about in that conversation, the folks who are often charged with fixing issues related to environmentalism are the same folks who caused the problem. And so he, as speaking as he does with an indigenous perspective and also working with students from a vast array of backgrounds, is trying to change that.
How do you see his story broadening the story about conservation, environmental stewardship in rural America? I mean, I hear quite a bit from farmers and ranchers, for example, about how they, in various ways, view their economic imperative with being stewards of the earth. Many farmers consider themselves the first line of defense, kind of the canary in the coal mine for what's going on with the landscape.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I should mention that Brett himself is descended from farmers on one side of his family, in particularly recent generational memory. But the angle he's coming at it, yeah, he works for food sovereignty and things that are definitely in the agricultural realm. But I think that if Brett were here, he would suggest that we mustn't, in our American obsession with productivity and capital, view our earth and our land as nothing but a mechanism to extract from, and that's how we got into the mess that we're in. And so I loved that conversation because he, like my family, many of whom are farmers, has the word spiritual came up in my question there to him, and it's because that's how it feels when you're that connected to the earth. Yeah, it might be how you make your living. But if you were trying to get rich in the world, you'd be doing something else.
Let's talk a little bit about 2020 politics. We are in D.C. after all, and we just can't help ourselves, especially because, you know, we're kind of talking red state, blue state already, which is a useful metric to an extent. Mm-hmm. But how do you see it? I mean, the larger national conversation kind of dividing the country into red states and blue states. We remember when Barack Obama spoke at the Democratic National Convention, he said, there are no red states or blue states. There's only the United States. And I think a lot of Americans now will be like, okay, that must have ended when he left.
Right. That was quaint. Right. No, it felt true at the time, didn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But how do you see it now in terms of the stories you're telling?
Sure. Well, in many ways, I still see the truth in that and believe it, and the numbers bear it out, and I'll tell you how. So in any given state that we tidily call red or blue, you know, that's it's a result of cable TV news where they need a graphic and they put up the United States and they color each state red or blue based on who won in the Electoral College. This is, like you said, useful to a point, but I think more so misleading in that in any one of those states, let's say all the red ones from 2016, like out of those 30 or so states, the majority of them saw, you know, somewhere around like 35-40% of voters voted for Hillary Clinton. And the flip is true in terms of conservative populations within blue states. There is some Variance, of course, in terms of which, like North Dakota was like 70-30 in terms of the split, which is more extreme than others. But what I'm getting at here is when we say red and blue and we use those definitively, we are erasing millions and millions and millions of people on both sides of the aisle. And I think that, and you know, part of this has to do with the trouble of the Electoral College, but it also, it becomes just in a metaphorical sense about our kind of understanding of ourselves as a nation. We have this concept of like lines and borders as though on one side there's one type of person and the other side there's a different type of person. And in fact, if you get granular, if you get down to the ground level, there's all types of people in all different places. There's racists in blue states and there's progressive activists in red states, and it's a big mesh that's much more complicated than that map would suggest.
Yeah, I would say just as a sidebar, I wish whenever I go on one of these TV shows to do a panel that some folks could see what happens before and after, where people on opposite sides of the table are perfectly nice, friendly, cordial, joking, laughing. They've known each other for years. They still have ideological differences, but they're not at each other's throats. Mm. Like you can't live in D.C. for any length of time and hate people on the opposite side of the political aisle. So right. I take your point. You're right. And it's even more nuanced here in D.C., but that's just not what you see. And I think it makes it easier for people to kind of look down on one another. We heard from some of our listeners who shared, and quite a few of you actually, shared your thoughts on feeling looked down upon by people from urban areas. Here's what Allison left in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Allison. I'm calling from a small town in Illinois. My husband is born and raised in Boston. And it's funny because whenever I go up there, because not only am I from a small town, I also have horses, I take care of animals, and I love farming. And I usually get called redneck, country bumpkin, hick, hillbilly, etc. And I really want people to realize that just because someone's from a small town does not make them any less of a person.
Well said, Allison. I really appreciate you sharing your story and your perspective with us. And Sarah, I wonder how you would react to that, especially bringing it back to politics in light of this term Trump country that has emerged since the election, all the connotations, mostly pejorative, that term entails.
Right. Yeah, I think all the points that your caller made now, like you just suggested, have been put into kind of a political hopper and taken on this additional term, Trump country, which tends to be bandied as synonymous with, you know, rednecks, backward country folks, when in fact that's not at all representative of who voted for Trump. Who voted for Trump was white people at all economic rungs, including the majority of college-educated ones. But as far as those, you know, the way that those terms sting, I remember growing up and feeling like, you know, I could sense that sort of derision, just like even in popular culture. And you've done shows about this recently, where there's a representation of a rural person as bucktoothed and stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think about this as like, well, when I got to graduate school in New York City and I'd see some of those attitudes and I'd be thinking to myself, like, my family, like, grew the wheat that's in the bread of the sandwich that you're eating right now while you're, you know, spouting this sort of nonsense. I think a new rule is if you've ever eaten at a farm-to-table restaurant, you can no longer lampoon farmers.
Now, I think on the flip side of that is that those images that created that trope of Trump country are real. And a lot of what people on the coasts and in urban areas are lampooning, mocking, looking down on actually happens. Those aren't made up. Those are real.
In what sense, I guess?
In the sense that, you know, some of these images in terms of Trump country of people, you know, shouting at rallies and those are not, you know, our eyes are not deceiving us.
Yes, that's true. And in that case, you know, I think it's just a hyperfixation, which, by the way, has made a lot of advertising revenue through ratings on television on that group. And that group is dangerous and it needs attention. It's also dangerous, though, to suggest that it represents the whole of that space. I sometimes tell a joke of, like, if you have a national reporter comes to a Midwestern farm town, is talking to someone wearing an ACLU hat, and they're like, could you point me towards somebody wearing a MAGA hat so I can report on this place?
So it'll be a balanced report.
Right.
I got a blue hat, I need a red hat, and then I can go back to the edit bay.
Yeah.
Sarah Smarsh is the author of Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Her new podcast is called The Homecomers, and it comes out on September 3rd. Sarah, thanks very much for talking to us.
Thanks so much, Joshua.
This conversation was produced by Orion Donovan Smith and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.